So again, good morning, everyone. So I am in the hall here at our center. 3, 6, 8 of our members are with me. And we have been on retreat since Tuesday evening. A retreat called Unfettering the Natural Mind. And it was a retreat that we call a wisdom retreat. And let me explain a little about that. So obviously, in terms of learning, in terms of understanding, in terms of gaining wisdom, hopefully we are gaining wisdom all the time from our life. Become wise means we are learning. We are learning lessons. We are understanding things more. And so as we develop wisdom about life, we're able to live in greater congruence with a good life, a peaceful life, a happy life, a life that causes the least suffering, does the least harm, and creates the most good. That is the function of wisdom. And it's not just to kind of, be smarter than everybody else or wiser than everybody else. It's not comparison. We want to gain wisdom about life so we can live right. Stop making the same mistakes. Maybe that's part of wisdom. We learn from our mistakes. We learn from the mistakes of others. We learn from observing life. So in our community, the Florida Community of Mindfulness, we have these three paths: the mindful living path, the Dharma path, and the wisdom path. This retreat was a wisdom path retreat, and I'll explain that in a minute. So the reason we have these three paths is because spiritual personal development is developmental. We begin somewhere, and hopefully we develop. The same way, as human beings, physiologically we develop, mental skills we develop, emotional skills we develop. There's lots of developmental psychology, which talks a lot about human development, but spiritually we develop to become beings that are more capable of living a life of understanding, intelligence, compassion, loving kindness, clarity. There are all these unfoldings that we want to bring into our life, but we all begin somewhere. And so we have a developmental path. And the reason our first path is called the mindful living path is really for two reasons. One reason is in the nature of our current society, American society, many people's interest begins with these days interest in knowing that meditation and mindfulness are good for us. We many of us in our culture and society are understanding in all areas of life, a concentrated mind, mindfulness, learning to live in the present, things like that are just therapeutically good for us. As well as, having a clear mind, a balanced mind, a mindful mind, a somewhat concentrated mind, a mind that is free of a lot of emotional ups and downs, is actually good for anyone following a spiritual path. So our mindful living path is not only an entranceway for many people who are coming interested in mindfulness and meditation, but also people who are interested in Dharma or spirituality or things like that. It's very important that they have a solid foundation. Because often people come to quote-unquote spirituality, seeking a spiritual path, which is good. But their minds are really not ready to incorporate what they are learning. Quite simply, we're often just too neurotic, or we are too emotionally up and down, or we're just so full of our own ideas and things, we really can't incorporate anything. as well as we don't have much of ability just to kind of have stability and groundedness in our ordinary life, right? So whether one is just interested in the therapeutic value of mindfulness and meditation, or whether one is really interested in a spiritual path, the mindful living path is a foundation. In it, we learn how to live a mindful life, and we learn how to work with our afflictive emotion and develop a certain degree of emotional stability. Having done that to some degree, and again, in our community, we have intensives, we have retreats for on the mindful living path to help people at that level gain those skills and abilities and understandings. But then, I thought somebody was saying something to you in the hall. But then for those who realize that mindfulness by itself is not a panacea, and I understand that's a little, mindfulness is being marketed these days as almost a panacea for anything. It's really not. It has many gifts, but there is something fundamentally lacking in just being mindful, because one can be, a mindful neurotic. One can be a mindful jerk. One can be much more present and grounded and still relate to the world and experience in the world in the same way we always did. So there's no real work, and the path of mindfulness is real no working on sort of beginning to change. You see, and the problem is people these days, and they're often frustrated, disappointed, because they think, oh, if I learn mindfulness and meditation, then I'll be calm and peaceful. But that's not true. You see, it can maybe in the moment calm us down. It can in the moment quiet us down. It can stabilize us when we get ungrounded, but we're still having to do it all the time just to kind of, hold our ground, so to speak. So for somebody who wants to look a little deeper, they go, well, why am I getting upset all the time? You see, why am I agitated? Why am I stressed? It's not just that I'm not only mindful, it's sort of the way I'm living my life, perceiving my life, and interacting with my life. There's something fundamental about the way I'm viewing life that's skewed, that's causing me always to feel off balance and agitated and have a lot of emotionality and be in conflict. So therefore now we have Dharma, where we really learn these ancient principles to help us understand really what's going on in life, why it is the way it is, why people are the way they are, why the world is unfolding the way it is. We sort of begin to learn some of the laws and mechanisms that are really kind of running the unfolding of this life, all life. So we study the Dharma, the way of understanding, the teachings of the Buddha, as well as we learn about a spiritual life, and we learn about an altruistic way of living. We begin to learn about the human capacity for love, and how to love, and how to be kind, and how to be compassionate, not just as religious values, but actually there's a technology, there are meditations, there are ways that one can develop all these qualities of the heart. As well as we begin to kind of analytically take a little deeper look at the mind and the self and ego and the role that ego plays in distorting reality. And it's always getting us into trouble living an egocentric life. So there are many aspects of Dharma, many teachings, many practices, many types of meditations at this level that we need to develop. And so we have our Dharma path, and within our Dharma path, we have intensives, we have retreats, where we really learn to incorporate many of these teachings, understand them more deeply, and sort of change our view of life So we have a view of life that really allows us to live much more peaceful, much greater ease, much more open, much more compassion, much more understanding, etc. And this is good. And for many of us, not just Dharma, but when one follows any spiritual path, religious path, it helps us become better people. And that is wonderful. So why the wisdom path? So this is because you might say, gee, I'm really studying the Dharma, practicing the Dharma. I'm a lot wiser than I used to be. I'm kind of wising up in life. I understand a lot more. I'm much more intelligent in my relations and in my work and how I handle and respond to things. So what is this wisdom? So in Buddhism, there are really two kinds of wisdom. There's a wisdom which is kind of a discriminating wisdom. It's an intellectual wisdom. It's a kind of intellectual intelligence of what we're talking about, right? It's kind of a natural intelligence that we can understand things. But it's still unfolding in the realm of thought, of thinking. But going back to the Buddha, who founded, the founder of Buddhism, in his, and Buddhism begins with his great enlightenment. His great enlightenment was not based on intellectual, theoretical understanding of any kind of doctrines or dogmas or teachings. Basically, he had a non-conceptual experience of what? Of the nature of his own mind. Now, why is that important? Well, because the teachings of Buddhism clearly state that even though a human being is made up of body, speech, and mind, mind is the primary mover. And most importantly, all this work we've been doing, transforming our thoughts, changing our thoughts, creating emotional system, learning to concentrate, all these kinds of things, learning to communicate. Everything in life, well, let's just be personal, everything in our life is unfolding in our minds. Every emotion we feel, every thought we feel, every memory we have, every sight we see, every sound we hear, every reaction, likes and dislikes, all our stories, everything is all unfolding in mind. And yet, we don't really know what a mind is. It sounds sort of ridiculous, but we've never really stopped to really investigate and understand this instrument that we're living our life through. And this is very important. This is probably the most important thing that we can do, is really understand the nature of my own mind. Understand the nature of my own self, not as a story, but as an actual entity of mind. We hear there's no self, but do I really know that, you see? I've heard those teachings. I've heard about self and non-self and ego and non-ego, but have I really looked into my own mind very deeply and actually seen myself, whether I really have a self? And if I do, what is it? We have thoughts in our mind. They lead us around all the time. They're endlessly coming and we're endlessly following them around. Good thoughts, bad thoughts, happy thoughts, angry thoughts, desirous thoughts, regretful thoughts. We have endless thoughts, but we never really investigate our own mind to see what actually is a thought, and where do they come from, and where do they go, and what is their nature, and are they real? We have feelings, we have emotions, but we really don't know them from the inside. What are they? If you don't know something, if you don't understand something, it's very easily to be fooled by them. So at a fundamental way, knowing the nature of your own mind, the nature of self, the nature of thought, right? Like right now, you know, for most of us, if we had a choice between having a quiet, restful mind or an active, busy mind, right, we would mostly all choose the what? The calm mind. We don't like the busy mind. Is that clear? Isn't that true? And yet, what if they're really intrinsically the same? Just like the ocean. The ocean has its surface where there are waves and things going on, but really 99% of the ocean is depth, where there's actually stillness. How many of us know our mind has that capacity? Know our minds at that depth? So that is what the wisdom path explores. And so the wisdom path puts a lot of emphasis, obviously, on meditation and direct experience, non-conceptual experience, and really developing understanding. But I mean, I realize as I'm saying all this, this sounds very kind of highfalutin. Actually, in this tradition, our Buddha mind, our true mind, is called our natural mind. It is really the mind that we were given in this life. It's our original mind. It's the mind that we all came into this life with. It is pure, it is undefiled, it is without any characteristics. You know, and if you see that in young children. And maybe some of us remember that in ourselves. But then there are all these layers, 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 layers of experience, layers of identity, layers of anything, which is covering it all over. So it is really meditation. It is the process of kind of peeling away the layers to see what's there. So that's the wisdom path. And so therefore we have, again, intensives and retreats on the wisdom path. And this leads me to this present moment. So again, we've just been participating. I think we had 53 participants in this retreat called Unfettering the Natural Mind. And it was our really first long online retreat. Again, I have been on retreat since Tuesday. So I am imagining that the coronavirus is still present in society, and we are still under various kinds of cautions and social distancing. So this was an online retreat. So outside of 8 people who joined me every day in the hall, 3 who slept over at the center, the rest that went home every night, there were 8 of us in the hall sort of manning the audiovisual things and just doing the things to support. Everybody else was online. Just to give you a sense, the schedule every day began at 6:30 and it went to 9. Our first session was from 6:30 to 8. Then there was breakfast. Of course, everybody at home did their own breakfast. Then we had a work period, both here at the center, but everybody in their home had an hour work period. Then a second session from 10 to 12, a third session from 2 to 5, and a fourth session from 7 to 9 p.m. And everybody, which was the majority of people at home, had made certain commitments to, you know, not be on their electronic devices, to be silent, just to kind of be on retreat and follow the schedule. And even, some people, or, you know, obviously many of the people at home may have lived with people who were not on it, so they sort of made arrangements to the best they can with the people they live with to let them know they're on retreat, and they might have stayed to their own room or different kinds of things. So we were all on a retreat together. And basically, to give you a sense of what went on in all these basically 4, 2, and 3 hour sessions, is basically in each time we would begin with meditation. And then I would, so basically we had a text called the Excellent Chariot. And these are, it's a kind of what they call practice text. So there's no theory, there's no teaching. It's just a series of meditative instructions. And so basically, as we went through the day, after maybe a half an hour meditation, I would spend 20, 30 minutes, basically, and everybody had a copy of the text. I would read through the section of the text that we were going to be working on, giving commentary and explanation, and then people would go off. We would kind of shut off the videos, and everybody would practice for 45 minutes, an hour. And then they would return, which means they would turn their videos on. And for maybe 20, 30 minutes, I would process it with them, answering any questions they had about the instructions, about the practice, as also hearing from people about what their experience was. And so this is pretty much what we did for 5 days. There would be the meditation, there would be instructions, commentary, there would be practice, and then the group would process, you know, I mean, not everybody could, there were 53 people, but there was enough. So in that way, you know, the retreat had a life to it, a community life to it. As well as during the course of the retreat, there were two small groups every day, then I would meet with all the members in these small groups of 5 or 6 people. So everybody was seen also in these small groups, but they could ask their questions anytime. So this is what we did for 5 days. Again, using this text that everybody had. And we kind of, the kind of questions that people were asked to experience were the kind of questions that most of us have never thought of even asking. And most of us in our experience, you know, like, where does the mind come from? Where does the mind stay? Where does it go? And these are not questions to be asked intellectually. These are questions to be answered by actually in the meditation, people looking into their minds to see their mind, if they have a mind, and where is it? And where does it come from? And where does it go? And where does it stay? And what is it like when it's moving? And what is it like when it's still? And then, I mean, then there's a whole series of questions. But then also a major piece of this is then turning and actually looking directly at the one who's asking the questions. When is that? What is that? Which really gets into the question of who am I? But not in an intellectual way, but by looking directly into the mind. And in that way, many, many people had experiences of seeing their original mind. A brief look, a brief glance, a deep, all kinds of way. I'm going to ask some members to share their experiences with you. And then the other big piece was, so there is a searching, looking, examining, investigating the mind. There's this turning and looking directly into that which is doing the investigation. And then third is learning to rest in the natural mind. The natural mind is not our fabricated mind. What is our fabricated mind? It is the mind that's endlessly thinking. It is the mind of likes and dislikes. It is the mind of self-identity. It is the mind that accumulates all its needs and its wants and has all its ego issues. And, you know, that's our constructed mind. But what is our original mind? What is our natural mind? What is the mind that we were actually born with before we even had language? What is that like? And is that still present? And is that still pure? So learning to rest in the natural mind as a meditative practice, and learning to handle the arising of thoughts in that natural mind is very much the meditative practice. And so that's what we did for 5 days. But I wanted to flesh that out a little bit. So this is totally unrehearsed. Actually, we only finished our last closing circle at 9 a.m. And then we had breakfast, and then we're back here at 10. So I've just asked some members who are here in the hall. I mean, there were, as I say, 53 people online, but sometimes if people are talking through their own computer, the Zoom isn't always great, but I think we have better control here. So I've asked some of our members just to talk about, and I'm going to actually ask some questions. So they didn't even have to rehearse, you know. So this is totally unrehearsed. I'm just going to ask some questions. So I've asked four members. How many years have you been a member? Four, a little over two, a little under two, Angie, 15. All right, so why don't we begin with under two and then go to over two. So can we give, Scott, maybe you could turn around. Can you see, is the, yeah. So observing protocols, just nod to me. We're still observing protocols? Or is the pandemic over? We're still wiping and doing all these things? This is asking all of you out there, just nod your head. We're still doing that, okay. So this is Scott. So Scott, you've been a member a little under 2 years. Have you been on retreats with us before? With a mindful living path retreats, Dharma retreats, wisdom retreats? So you've been on a couple of retreats. This was your first wisdom retreat? How what was your experience? All right, they can't hear. The mic wasn't on.
Can you hear me now?
Okay, thank you for, yeah, so please give us feedback if you can hear, just do something like that, because I can see you now. So, yes, so just begin again, Scott. But you could hear me when I introduced him. Yes, okay, right.
So, on Tuesday night, when we started meditation, Fred led us through some meditations to help us explore our natural mind. And I had this feeling of bliss, euphoria, whatever you want to call it, better than any high I'd ever experienced chasing through my late teens and 20s. And I remember thinking, like, I could go home now. Like how can you top this? just the experience of that natural feeling and knowing it was all natural, and it was my mind, and it was the way things were supposed to be. It was just the most incredible experience I've ever had.
And then what happened? So you didn't go home?
Didn't go home.
So you stuck it out? Was it downhill after that?
No. You know, we kept going deeper and deeper, and I think it was Friday night, I've lost sense of all days and time. We did some meditations where Fred actually just came into the room in the evening and just had us basically start letting go of everything. All the stuff that we carry around, all the hurt, all the just letting go of thing after thing. And I remember sitting there with like tears coming out of my eyes, like all this stuff I've been carrying around for all these years, it's nothing. All the pain, all the hurt, all the disappointment, all the whatever is just not there. And Fred always uses the analogy a lot of like peeling back an onion. And I was thinking about this morning, that for maybe the last 3 or 4 months, if you asked me, you know, how are you? I'd be like, oh, I'm good. Like, I've done a lot of work. I've done a lot of healing. Everything's good. Like, there's no more layers to peel back. But I was still doing the work, even though I wasn't maybe necessarily seeing the results. And with all the work that we did this weekend, it's like all the layers of the onion have just cracked. They're just, you know, it's like there's all this other stuff and all these other realizations and just, yeah. I mean, it's just hard to put into words.
If you could put it into words, what would you say was kind of, having gone on a wisdom retreat, having been on a Dharma path retreat, a mindfulness path, what was the difference?
Direct experience. Looking into my mind and the realization that what I think is my mind and what I think is myself, it doesn't exist. I've done a lot of reading, I've done a lot of studying, I'm very intellectual. I'm very good at conceptualizing things and figuring things out. But you can't figure this out. You can't get there intellectually. You can't go from A to Z and get there. You have to experience it.
Anything else, Scott, you'd say? Was the retreat hard? I mean, keeping to the schedule and...
You would think waking up at 4:30 in the morning, driving a half hour here, sitting in meditation and other things for 14 hours, you'd think it's exhausting. I'd go home, I'd sleep, I'd be up at 4 o'clock before my alarm ready to go. I'm ready for another week.
All right. Well, thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
So, Maggie? Can you be seen, Maggie? Why don't you scoot over and Scott maybe scoot back? Yeah. Bill is saying you can see Maggie? Yeah. You can be seen, Maggie. So Maggie, you've been a member here how long?
A little over 2 years.
2 years, and you've been on any retreats before?
Like Scott, I started with the Mindful Living Path,
mm-hmm.
And then moved into some Dharma Path retreats. Now a part of the Dharma Transmission Group,
that's
so
right.
A couple of those. But this is my first wisdom retreat.
And how did you find your first wisdom retreat?
Well, for me personally, this was kind of a renewal. I've done some of, or learned some of this stuff about a year ago in Empty Cloud on a solitary retreat.
Right, so just tell people that Empty Cloud is what I'm saying.
So Empty Cloud is, for members, you have the chance to go on a solitary retreat where you personally work with Fred every day, and much like what we just went through with the wisdom retreat, it actually really reminded me of it. You basically have your schedule where you're meditating and processing and reading and eating. And that's your daily business.
So how was this wisdom retreat for you?
So this one, it was kind of a renewal, like I said. So I shared in our closing circle not too long ago about the imagery that Fred shared, I think, on the first or second day. I don't know, the days are running together by now. And he mentioned the wheel, and my mind made it a bicycle wheel. So I learned, so I was on the right path, riding my bike all along since that empty cloud experience, but something was a little off on my front wheel, so to speak.
It wasn't running true.
What?
It wasn't running true.
It wasn't running true.
Yes.
It wasn't quite put together correctly. and so I found really from the first day, renewing some of this energy, but also getting the guidance of Fred with how to work with the teachings and how to process them as an individual, really kind of, it was almost like, this is a nice ride going forward. So yeah, I found it very fruitful and nice.
Do you want to share any specific kind of experiences you might have had, or insights, breakthroughs, tragedies?
I'm not sure that it was quite any breakthroughs like some of the other people have shared throughout the last couple days, but it was really just, it's so hard to describe in words. Kind of an opening, almost as if I'm a peg going back to a hole that I'm supposed to be in. I don't know. It just feels natural. Returning home.
Yeah. I think a lot of, as we go deeper in the practice, a lot of these things we say all the time, such as coming and going, we never leave home. You know, a lot of the things that we say sort of in our chants or in some of our songs and different things, all of a sudden we understand what they really mean, right? Coming to our true home, that sense of, like you say, you know, when you come home, when you've been away from home and you've had all kinds of stuff your day, when you come home, there's often a great sense of what? Relief and letting go and comfort, and it feels good to be home. And many of us do not feel comfortable within at a deepest level. That is that analogy that Maggie's talking about, that, you know, dukkha is that word in Buddhism for suffering. And people often, you know, think of, you know, the grosser kinds of sufferings and pains of human life, which are certainly, prevalent. But at the deepest level, dukkha is described as just what you said. It's a wheel that doesn't run true on its axle. So even when it's turning, even when we're going through our life, and even when things are okay, there's always a little friction. It's never quite right. And that's why oftentimes dukkha is described as kind of an innate dissatisfaction. It's like no matter what it is, even the good things, there's always something missing. And so many of us mistake that and think, well, I just need to get more. I need to get more, do it more. You know, it's sort of like the addictive spiral, rather than just acknowledging, yeah, that's just the nature, because I'm not experiencing life from my true home, my true mind, my true awareness. I'm lost in the world of self and conceptualization. So good. Thank you, Maggie. So next, Kevin. Now, Kevin, you've been a member of how long? But Kevin is also... I mean, your entrance into Buddhism and Dharma did not begin with us, did it? So you got into Buddhism, Dharma, meditation how long ago, Kevin?
25 years ago.
25 years ago. And you've been involved in different kinds of Buddhist groups?
Yes.
Such as?
Tibetan Buddhism, primarily.
You were involved with Tibetan Buddhism for many years?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other Buddhism before you came to us?
No, I mean, you know, I've kind of been a seeker from early on when I went to college, and Hinduism, and did that, and then started exploring and, you know, started studying the Dharma.
Okay, so you've been with us now 4 years. Have you been on many retreats with community?
I've been on several. Some at the Franciscan Center, and some of the non-residential, and then some of the Wisdom Retreat up in Gainesville. You know, my connection with FCM.
Oh, that's right.
We invited Fred up. We have a Thich Nhat Hanh Sangha in Gainesville.
That's right.
We invited Fred, and Betsy and Brian came, and that was really kind of my deepening connection.
Now I remember. Good. So you have been on a Wisdom Retreat with us before once?
Yes. I was at Southern Dharma last year as well.
Oh, that's right. You were at thank you. I knew I'd seen you somewhere before, Kevin. That's good. So, Kevin, how is this retreat for you? So Kevin's obviously a practitioner who's been around the block. He's been experienced. He's been a meditator since college. So how is this retreat fitting into all that?
Well, as my teachers and Fred remind me, that come back to the beginner's mind, so that when I think that I've been practicing a long time, or the analogy of the onion to be peeled, when I think it's done, I'm in trouble. You know, there's always something, you know, as Ty would say, there's always something to be learned and experienced. So I would even say from the first night, we were encouraged to leave the past behind, to set the parameters for our retreat in my mind. And the instruction that was really helpful. The instruction that was really helpful was just to be fresh and be present with what's happening. So not that I knew anything, and Fred introduced, you know, this text, and to follow along. So one of my intentions was to show up and follow the instructions, because I trust those who I consider to be wise, and I consider Fred to be very wise.
And then what happened? So you went out and you set your intention to follow the instructions and to trust the guidance and to have a fresh, open beginner's mind. And then what happened, Kevin?
I think what's really important about this kind of practice for me is, like Scott, I can be very conceptual and in my head. Consider myself a good student. But it's like you have to let go of those tools to really want to explore that looking inward, that those same tools, they don't serve me in this. And the instructions lead to just, in particular, you know, one of the exercises that Fred led us in, Scott mentioned, was about this letting go. And what I remember in that process was letting go of all sorts of things, but it was also taking off the clothes of all the roles that I have and how I embody them or, you know, controlled or trapped by those. What was really helpful was that kind of sense of great relief and letting go, that I've put down this weight. But what was really insightful about it, as we came out of that, it was like I can put those clothes back on in roles and act from a much more awakened view, that I don't have to not be a father or a husband or work, but I can come back to that with a freshness and put on my work role with a more spacious, light way of moving. And that was really empowering, that I just didn't have to have that naked awareness, but I could take that with me as I moved about in the world. And that's, you know, that's part of the work, is because it's easy to get swept away with work or relationships or the world. And so for me, what's really helpful about taking this kind of time out is that it reinforces and it creates kind of those grooves to say, I have this capacity, I have this trust and confidence, and if I just follow the path and stay connected with that awakened space, I can move through the world in a much lighter at ease.
Yeah, so that's actually, that reminded me, that is really a very peculiarity of American Buddhists, following instructions. We have such a problem with following instructions. The path is so simple when we follow instructions. But there is something about, you know, we could have sociologists and psychologists spend a lot of time analyzing us, but our capacity for following instructions, trusting the instructions, trusting the instructor, not thinking that we know better, is very deeply ingrained in us. Which, you know, again, in some areas of life, that may be okay. But at a certain level, in terms of our spiritual development, and we need to just follow the instructions. Then it becomes simple. The path becomes simple. Just put one foot after the other. Stay on the path. Follow the yellow brick road. It'll take you to Oz. You know, and for many of us, that is the hardest thing to do. So has that been a hard thing for you to do in the past in your years of Dharma, or are you a fairly compliant Dharma student?
I'm fairly compliant. But
you are.
But I would say that I would say in my, you know, study of Buddhism, what's important, I mean, go back to think about the Buddha was, don't do this because I tell you, but look at your experience. So gaining the confidence in following the instructions over time, then feels that I can be in line, and that's, you know, I can trust that.
Good, thank you, Kevin. Just by the way, so we all know that these are real people. Kevin, what do you do for a living? You work?
I do software consulting.
And Maggie, what do you do for a living? Maggie's a professor. And Scott, what do you do for a living? He's an analyst. Okay, good. So you think it's possible to practice even the wisdom path in playing your roles in life? Yeah. Everybody nodded yes. So now Angie. And yes. Bill's telling you to just move over a little bit more, Angie.
How's that?
So, Angie, you've been practicing with the community how long?
About 15 years.
About 15 years. So you are the senior of this group, the elder?
In some respects, not in others, I'm sure.
And have you ever been on a retreat before?
Oh, yes.
And have you been on Mindful Living Path retreats?
Yes.
Have you been on Dharma Path retreats?
Yes.
Have you been on Wisdom retreats?
Yes.
How many retreats, if you add them all up, how many do you think you've been on in the last 15 years?
Ooh, probably 30 or so at
30
least.
30 or so, okay. Mm-hmm. And how many Wisdom retreats? I mean, traditionally we did a Wisdom retreat up at Southern Dharma, a 7-day one for a number of years and a few others. Have you been on most of those?
Yes, I have. So that's probably 8 or 10 Wisdom retreats.
Okay. So you have 8 or 10. So you are our senior in many ways. So tell us about your experience on this retreat, if you would be so kind.
So this was different, and perhaps the most significant aspect that it was different from other Wisdom retreats I've been on is that I wasn't practicing from my conceptual mind. So everything Fred was just saying with Kevin, I've always tried to follow the instructions, but at the same time, I bring a lot of concepts, you know, of what I've read, what I've listened to, into the practice. So I think in many respects, the practice hasn't been pure. And on this retreat, I think perhaps I'm finally maturing in the Dharma, but I think also Fred's instructions and these teachings were so wonderful that to just put it all down, and as in a lot of past wisdom retreats, it's been like if you've ever done rock climbing, like you have, I have a tenuous finger hold, but I didn't have a good handhold on what it felt like to sit and just rest in this natural mind. So I felt like I would have these experiences, but I would slip back pretty quickly. Maybe, you know, if I stayed in that, what felt like a state for 2 hours, it was a big deal. But then I would immediately start thinking about it and falling back again. And it would just sort of close up on me. And yes, there's progress, but I really live most of my life from the stance of self and thoughts. And very early on in this 5-day retreat, I just let that go. And I realized just this, and it was so full of ease and clear. And I had the ability to stay and actually see how wonderful it was, because I think in the past, thoughts would be so compelling and stimulating that I'd be seduced back. And just sort of lose that, you know, the awareness that was there would be kind of covered over with thought again. So here, that didn't happen. And I just stayed with it. And it was a retreat where, I mean, I guess you could say I was busy. I was primarily doing the AV. I led a number of guided meditations. I was the soup cook every night. And in the past, my mind would have been so full of anticipating and planning, because that's my habit energy, is like to make sure, you know, that things are under control and I've got everything covered. And I just let that go and everything was easy. It never felt like there was too much. Nothing was ever a problem. It's just this, now what? Fred would beckon me back, you know, and sometimes in the past, like, oh, what have I done or what do I need to do? There was none of that. It was just like, just open clarity. What, you know, what's next? So, yeah, it was wonderful.
Good. So now you've been very involved with the center in many ways for many years now. Really, very essential to where we are. But before that, you had a career. What did you do?
I was an employee benefits consultant with large pension plans.
Yeah, so let me, it's interesting. You know, in the, and it's, again, you know, I have been fortunate that I've practiced in two major wisdom traditions. But to me, Zen is a wisdom tradition, and the Great Perfection is a wisdom tradition, because both of them are based on realization of our true mind. And they are both based on direct experience of that. And they are both based on the understanding that it's already here. There are many spiritual paths, even Buddhist paths, where you are, you know, you're starting in ignorance and you're moving step by step gradually towards something called enlightenment, right? We're here and we got to get there. But the Great Perfection traditions and the Zen traditions begin with the Buddha statement, we are already whole and complete right now. Our Buddha mind is right here, right now. It has always been here. And so therefore, as opposed to a striving and getting somewhere, the wisdom path is really, as you think you've heard people say, it's an uncovering. It's an uncovering of what's already here. It's our original mind. We don't have to make it. We don't have to create it. We don't have to fabricate it. We don't have to do anything. It's already here. All we have to do is kind of recognize it, notice it, and learn to live from it. Now you might say, well, all right, so what? Yeah, so I guess I'd say to you is when you trod the wisdom path and you have experience, when you understand the nature of your mind, when you have an experience of your original natural awareness, unfettered mind, it makes life easy. It makes the path easy. It makes all the things you want to do in your life easier. You see? It makes being kind easier. It makes being compassionate easier. It makes being selfless easier. It makes being, all the things all the practices we're doing, patience, generosity, all the paramitas. It makes the whole path easier because it's not based on self. It's not based on me. It's not based on separation. It's not just based on thoughts. And even ideals are thoughts. It's based on something that's real and grounded. Actually, in the Great Perfection tradition, the wisdom practices are called secret practices. Secret practices means you don't tell anybody. They're just for you, you see? A lot of the other practices, can be seen. You know, if we learn to speak compassionately and kindly, if we learn to be patient, if we learn to be helpful, if we learn to be generous, we practice many, many things. Accepting. See, these are the attributes that are seen, you see. But these wisdom teachings and practices and realizations go on in our minds, you see. They can't be seen. So that's why they're called, they're like, you have a secret, you see. Nobody knows. So we don't often talk about, I'm practicing this or I'm practicing that or I'm on this, because it's not about that. But if you really have seen into the empty non-self nature of your own mind, being selfless, being there for others, is not hard at all. It's very easy. Giving, being generous of your time, your things, it's easy because there's no self holding on to everything. It's easy to be kind and generous and compassionate because there's no self-keeping score of whether we're getting it all back. There's no self always scanning the universe, making sure its needs and its wants are getting met and that it's always being treated the way it wants to be treated, you see. There's so much energy we don't even realize that goes into sustaining ourselves. And then all the energy that comes from aversion and attachment and all the emotionality that arises from living in the dramas of self. We don't even realize how much energy, right? Many people talk about, they don't want to be vulnerable or they have to keep up walls, they have to keep up barriers. But have we ever asked ourselves how much my energy goes into maintaining these constructs? And what if that energy was freed? What if all the neurotic energy that I put into doubt, that I put into, just going back and forth? I mean, you know what I'm saying? How much my energy is, expended in just maintaining hurts and angers and fears and worries and disappointments. And you know what I'm talking about? See how much of our energy goes into all that. So this wisdom path helps really at the very core free us of that. So then we have an amazing amount of energy available. Good energy available to really manifest very freely in the world the way we want to. Again, in our community, we are fortunate because we have much help that we were able to offer these practices in our intensives, in our retreats, at the Mindful Living, at the Dharma, at the Wisdom Path, so that all of us can develop together, but that all of us can develop where we are, you see. We shouldn't be in a hurry. I mean, the reason we're having this discussion today, I don't know if we've had this before, is because it just so happens we have been online, and here we are, and the retreat is ending, and this is the final talk of the retreat too. So it's all come together. So many of you, some of you listening, who the things that were talked about today and the Dharma, the Wisdom Path still seems far away, that's good. You don't have to be in a hurry. It's good to build a strong foundation. One can want to get to the mountaintop and have that aspiration because we know that it's quite wonderful up there. The view is quite wonderful up there. But one can still be down in the valley and know that, we don't have the skills and the strength yet, to climb it. But we can still have the aspiration that even as we're training in the valley, even when we were training at the quote-unquote lower levels, it's really all about climbing the mountain. And so when we're walking the Mindful Living Path, Dharma Path, Wisdom Path, and put in these divisions is kind of not true. If you look in your own mind, you will not see these demarcations. And in life, you will not see these demarcations. It's just a way that we can operationalize our path and let people know the possibilities of the path. So again, wherever we are, if you're at the Mindful Living Path, that is, to me, that is the most important path, really, because it is the foundation. And with a strong foundation, a strong stability, strong trust, strong confidence, then one, if you can think about, climbing a mountain, if your confidence in yourself, if your confidence in the guidebook, if your confidence in the guide, if you're not sure your abilities and capacities, you're not sure you even want to, climb it, it's going to be a difficult journey. And you may never complete it. But if you spend time at the beginning, making sure this is something you want to do and getting all the requisite skills and abilities, so when you make the climb, it goes smoothly, it is well worth it. So, this presentation wasn't to get everybody in the Wisdom Path. I'm not getting commissioned for signing people up for the Wisdom Path today, so that's not the case here. It's just sort of to give a fuller, complete picture while we can here today so people understand, what the Wisdom Path is about a little bit, a little explanation, and then a little first-person experience. So thank you all for listening. For those of you who've been on retreat for the last 5 days, we had our closing circle earlier today, but this is the real ending of our retreat. And again, hopefully, as I think you've heard people say, that we will take these wonderful teachings and practices, and most importantly, experience this deeper understanding we have about who and what we are into our life, into our work, into our relationships, into the reality of our lives, and make them better. That's the, you know, the proof is in the pudding. And to have a great practice but have a mediocre life is really not what it's about. Okay. I'd rather have a mediocre practice and a good life. So, the proof of our practice is in our life, in our relationships, and how we feel, how we go about the world. So please take it with you. All those who are on retreat, take it with you. So good. Thank you, everyone. We will end for now.